have with us in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Hello.
Hey there.
Joff is playing with our Happy Face Magic 8 Ball.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out how the program's going to go, and the Magic 8 Ball is really seriously inaccurate this morning. It says you look marvelous. And
wow.
You've never been accused of that. it's defective. Can we send it back?
We will. We'll get right on that.
Yeah.
So let's jump into things since we have so much to cover, as we have for months now. Olszewski was outed this week.
Yeah, Joseph Olszewski, who was giving interviews just before he left for a few days at his ranch at the end of last week, saying, you know, I'm in it for the long haul. I'm really looking forward to restoring my credibility. We need to instigate healing in the school district. You know, all the good happy face things that the school district is so good at saying. And Monday he comes up and says, well, I have to give 6 months notice according to my contract. So it's 6 months starting today. I'm out. And we have yet another search committee in town to go with the ones at UW and, you know, all the City Light and all the other places where incompetent administrators have been either forced out or fled for greener pastures. Joseph Olszewski left for many, many reasons and lost support from within the constituencies that make up the school district for many, many reasons, only a few of which have to do directly with the gaping budget hole that was discovered last year on his watch, and which is just now, with this budget that is coming in for the coming school year, trickling down to the classrooms and resulting into some fairly severe budget cuts, especially in the high schools. And an awful lot of it has to do with the culture of the school district itself, and it should be something that people who care about the schools in this community and people who care about accountability in this community and where their tax money goes should really be paying attention to when three of the school board members of the seven come up for re-election, or three of the school district seats actually come up, because one of them will be open this coming fall. There's already some people who are exploring candidacies, and some pretty good activist groups, CCCS and some other groups that are trying to recruit and line up school board candidates. And I would encourage anybody who's interested in that to start exploring the possibility, because one of the real problems for a long time in the school district, and we saw this play out with the really kind of amazing speed with which Olszewski suddenly went from, you know, everything is all right, this, and the school board saying everything is all right. Well, yeah, there was these $32 million in missing money that we're going to have to deal with, and there's all these reserves that we did have to deal with the state budget cutbacks that we're going to have to spend instead on last year's budget hole, so we don't have any money to deal with the state budget cutbacks that are going to be coming this year. But there's also been this tendency over the last several years to go with whatever the new fad is in terms of transformation is the big one right now, is the big key of how we're going to rethink all of the ways in which we're doing our lesson plans, all the ways in which we budget for the schools. We've had any number of these new schemes that have been brought in under Olszewski and under John Stanford over the last decade or so, and the result has been a tremendous amount of change in the schools over the last decade. Some of it's been for the better, some of it's been for the worse. You've got the Wassels coming in 3 years, and the district still only has, at the 10th grade level, which has to be passed in 3 years in order to graduate, about a third of the students actually passed that this past year. So they've still got tremendous problems with racial disparities in performance and discipline and dropout rates and all the rest of that. And a lot of the constituencies that have been pressuring the school district to deal with those problems have been met with a happy face. It's been, you know, everything is all right, everybody loves each other, and been very dismissive toward the concerns of the district. And that includes gifted students, it includes the alternative schools, it includes the assignment policies. So whoever comes in, you know, when Olszewski leaves in September, is going to have their hands full. And you know, some accountability is necessary from the community, because it hasn't even been Olszewski's problem as much as it has been the school board's problem, that they have not fostered a culture of accountability at all, and that included Olszewski, who in turn did not require very much of it from either the schools or the very bloated administration that is still sucking up a lot of the budget that it shouldn't be sucking up. So that's a lot of the issues that have led to his ulster are still going to be there this coming year and are still going to be facing whoever comes in.
All right. You mentioned the state budget having some problems.
Yeah. And as people might recall, Governor Gary Locke put out his draft of the state budget, and he decided that instead of raising taxes, he would cut a lot of spending, including kicking tens of thousands of people off of the basic health plan, the state's basic health plan, low-income people who probably need that coverage the most.
And don't have any other alternatives, which is why they're on the basic health plan.
Right. So that would be adding to the rolls of the uninsured in the state of Washington. How did the legislature respond to Gary Locke's draft budget? Well, the Republicans pretty much threw up their arms and started to cheer and say, you know, look at this. This is great. It's almost as if we have a Republican governor. You know, this is exactly what we want. And they immediately sat down and they drafted a budget that looked very, very, very similar to what Gary Locke had proposed. And the Democrats have ever since been playing catch up, and they haven't been very successful. The House Democrats, now it's exactly the opposite here in the state of Washington as it is in the federal. In the federal system, in the federal Congress, the Democrats have a not a majority, but they're pretty strong presence in the Senate, and they're a definite minority in the House. Here in the state of Washington, the Democrats control the House, and they have a minority in the Senate, and the Republicans control the Senate. So the Senate Republicans have put forward a budget that looks very, very much like Governor Locke's budget, with a few, they've kind of tweaked where the cuts are some, but they have no new taxes in their budget, and they're making a lot of cuts to social services. In the House, the Democrats can't even get together to put together a Democrat version of the budget. They're still fighting it out, duking it out, and what they're coming up with is very small raise in the sales tax and a lot of cuts that look similar to what Locke had proposed, although they want to not make as the deep cuts to the basic health plan. They're making cuts elsewhere in social services.
Yeah, and the incompetence of the leadership in the House is under a man from Seattle, Frank Chopp.
Yeah, and Chopp was the guy last year who said, okay, let's not have the legislature pass a transportation plan. Let's put it before the voters. And of course, the voters voted it down because it included a new gas tax. The voters will never vote for a new gas tax. This year, nobody's made any mention of doing that. Chopp is sitting on his hands as far as the transportation plan is concerned, and the legislature is trying to go forward and pass some kind of increase in the gas tax, albeit about half of what the last year's plan would have been. But nobody's talking about putting it before voters, because they looked at Chopp's failure last year and said, huh, that was a good idea.
All right. Keep things away from the voters.
Well, you know, we elect the legislature to do the dirty work for us, you know, and when it comes to having to raise the taxes somewhere, it's really, we prefer to have them do it and then bitch and complain and you know, vote a few of them out and vote a few new people in. But when it comes down to the electorate making decisions like having to raise taxes, will always wimp out.
Yeah, and you know, realistically, given the shortfall in the budget and given the local economy, there is no realistic alternative.
There really isn't.
Other than to raise revenues somewhere that does not harm more people than You know, the cuts harm more people than the raising the taxes would. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, and right now we have the legislature doing what they think the voters want, which is raising the state sales tax, which is probably the most inequitable tax. And the legislature cannot do a state income tax. It has to be something that the voters agree on.
The legislature also cannot bring itself to close any of the enormous loopholes or any of the enormous amount of corporate welfare that is part of the state budget also.
No, and in fact, we saw that particularly with a governor who is more Republican than Democrat, even though he has a D after his name, our Republican governor, Gary Locke, supports more business tax cuts. In fact, he supported the cut that we talked about last week that would give big businesses a very big tax break.
All right. Well, before we jump to the international issues, I have to mention that there actually was a bright spot to this week, something I never thought would happen. They began finally draining the sodium from the Fast Flux test facility, which means that's
may we have a moment of silence for the final death of Fast Flux. What that means for people who have not followed Hanford issues over the years, the Fast Flux test facility is a nuclear reactor facility that lost its original mission a number of years ago at Hanford. It was shut down in, 91, something like that, for safety reasons. And the business community in the Tri-Cities and various constituencies within the DOE and Hanford contractors have been trying to find a new mission for it ever since. And for that reason, it has been on something called hot standby, which is to keep it running in order to find that new mission at something like $32 million per year in tax money ever since. And there have been some insane schemes over the years, most of which, fortunately, have petered out.
Including to privatize the facility,
yes,
right?
Including to privatize the facility. And we talked about that on this program at the time that it happened as being this breathtaking fraud that Patty Murray was trying to push. But it finally, you know, once it goes off of hot standby, once they start shutting it down, it becomes prohibitive to try and start it back up, and that is what finally happened this week. So so the chances that more nuclear production will happen at Hanford in any time in the foreseeable future just dramatically dropped this week.
Okay. So let's move along to international news. Iraq, of course, keeping headlines as it has for weeks.
I'll talk a little bit about the meeting that happened this week on Tuesday. The U.S. has been pretty anxious now because there's obviously not enough U.S. troops in the country to keep order, much less govern the country, even though the U.S. viceroy has finally taken up shop there, Jay Garner. So they've been in a rush to get an Iraqi government going. So Tuesday, what they did is they got about 80 representatives, hand-picked representatives, together in near Ur, which is an ancient civilization site in Iraq, south-central Iraq. And they started them talking about getting together a government, what kind of government they would want. They tried to get them to agree on some points of unity. And what happened was...
And none of these people have actual constituencies within Iraq.
That's right. They were very heavily dominated by exile. By Iraqi exiles, who most of whom haven't been in the country for at least 10 years and have no constituency there. Many of them didn't have any constituency when they lived in the country. They were simply, you know, technocrats who decided to defect, or they were people whose relatives were part of the anti-Saddam group or something. And these people decided to leave because of the threat of being arrested or jailed. So a lot of them have no constituency and never have. What's interesting is that a few of them who do or who are Iraqi, who have been living in Iraq for all this time, are people that were handpicked by the United States. So, for example, there was only one guy among the 80 delegates who was a Shiite cleric, a Shiite holy man, and he was the one guy that the U.S. could find who wants a secular state. So what happened this week was Friday prayers came along, the first time since Saddam took power that the Shiites could actually have a full Friday prayer session and have been able to exercise their religious rituals since Saddam took power. So this has been the first Friday for them. that they could do that. All of the imams, the Shiite Muslim clerics, told their assembled people, and there were thousands all over the country, in fact, hundreds of thousands all over the country, who came to Shiite mosques to worship, and that's also true for Sunni Muslims who turned up at Sunni Muslim mosques to worship on Friday. Their religious leaders told them, look, we don't want the Americans here. We don't want them to handpick a government for us. We want our own Islamic state, and we want Iraqis to be able to choose who their leaders will be. And so as soon as Friday prayers were over, you had people pouring out of the mosques and into the streets and demonstrating. In Baghdad, you could read the American press and read that there were thousands in the streets in Baghdad. If you read the British press...
Many, many more.
Yeah, if you read the British press, they say tens of thousands. If you read, if you go further afield and read the Muslim press or the wire service reports from reporters who are actually Western reporters who are actually in the country, they say hundreds of thousands were in the street demonstrating against the U.S. occupation. Now, here in the U.S., you might read the Washington Post and get this patronizing view of, oh, isn't it nice, the Iraqis are free now, they can demonstrate, and so they chose to demonstrate against the Americans now that Saddam Hussein is gone. It's so nice they're exercising their free speech. Well, excuse me, but that's patronizing, because these people are really demanding that the U.S. step back and let them choose their own government, and that's not what's happening.
Yeah.
What's happening is what happened in Afghanistan, where the U.S. allowed the government to be taken over by a group of warlords that they worked with in the Northern Alliance, and then proceeded to push out other warlords that they didn't want, who are now in the eastern part of Afghanistan and forming the core of a group of extremely fundamentalist religious fighters who are reconstituting a force that the Taliban had. And that's what's actually going on in Afghanistan. A lot of people think that the U.S. troops there are fighting remnants of the Taliban. What they're fighting is they're fighting these warlords who were not incorporated into the process, who were kicked out. And it's really a civil war situation going on in Afghanistan.
As opposed to some of the handpicked butchers that actually have
taken power. That actually are running the government.
Various parts of
yeah.
the country.
And you're actually seeing some criminals taking prominent positions in Iraq right now. Ahmed Chalabi, who's taken up a post in Baghdad and started hiring his own militia members with money that he swindled from his bank deals in Jordan and in Switzerland. The guy actually...
And who's a longtime friend and his patron is a guy named Richard Pearl, by the way.
Yeah, and Chalabi, actually, if he was deported to Jordan, would have to serve a 22-year prison sentence because he's been convicted of bank fraud there.
He's a
criminal.
Yeah.
And he's the Pentagon's choice to be the next president of Iraq. It's pretty clear that the Pentagon flew him in, have set him up, and provided him with protection all this time. There's another guy who went into the city of Mosul and is trying to declare himself the mayor, and members of his own tribe say that the guy is a thief. And is a criminal. So the U.S. is becoming associated with thugs in Iraq as well, because they don't want to deal with the leaders on the ground, and particularly because those leaders are talking about an Islamic state. And unfortunately, unlike in Afghanistan, the people that the U.S. is pushing out of the talks right now represent the majority of the population. And that's going to be a big problem down the road.
Yeah. The other interesting thing that's going on that's very analogous to what happened in Afghanistan, and really it's a shame that American media and the American public has such a short memory, because this really was only, 17 months ago. The Americans have really had a fascinating level of disinterest for finding out what happened under Saddam Hussein's regime, who was in Saddam Hussein's regime, bringing any of those people to accountability, or even being able to locate them or locate any of their records, or, for that matter, any accountability into what the Americans did during their bombing campaigns. For example, the large family that was killed when the Americans bombed a residential neighborhood, saying they thought Saddam and his top aides were in this particular house in a residential area in Baghdad. A week and a half later, you have Iraqi people, pulling small babies out, a baby out of the crater.
A whole family
out of the crater. The Americans never even showed up to find out whether any of Saddam's people were actually there or not.
And in fact, he did appear. Residents of another neighborhood said that he did appear 2 days later, that this video that's being shown on Abu Dhabi TV is actually a true video, according to the residents of the neighborhood where it was taken. They said, yes, on April 9th, he was there. Mm-hmm. And the American press have not printed any reports of interviews of people who live in that neighborhood, although the British press have. Yeah. And so there is quite a bit of evidence that Saddam Hussein escaped that bombing.
Yeah. And speaking of escape, I mean, the Americans, they found a couple of people, but they really haven't found any of the ministers, any of the high-ranking people. No, excuse me, they found a finance minister.
A couple of Saddam Hussein's relatives.
Yeah, but they have not found the vast majority of the upper echelon of people in Saddam Hussein's regime, almost all of which seem to have escaped somehow. And you
virtually have, overnight, as
yeah,
if
virtually,
an order were given, okay, now's the time to evacuate.
Yeah, exactly. The Iraqi army did not mount any defense of Baghdad. They basically said, okay, let's get out of here. And they managed to very successfully, even though the Americans essentially were surrounding Baghdad. You kind of wonder how this was able to happen. At the same time, you have almost all of the ministries, and we're talking 35 at least, according to Western reporters who've been reporting in the last couple of days, which have been on fire. You know, they've been arsoned, they've been burned in the last 3 days while American troops have stood and watched by gangs of people who have been driven into town, set the fire, and then been driven out. Now, if these people are being paid, you know, they weren't being paid by Saddam Hussein's regime because they would have just pocketed the money and then forgotten about it once Saddam Hussein left power. So the question is, who's paying them? And why don't the American forces seem to care or try and stop this from happening? So you have all of these records being destroyed. You have places where records do exist. For instance, some of the places where dissidents were tortured over the past years, and some of the war crimes that were committed, and some of the human rights crimes that were committed. And as in Kabul, after the Taliban left, none of this stuff is being looked at by British or American soldiers, at least not yet. None of the information as to some of the crimes being committed by the regime or any of the things around, potentially looking for evidence of weapons of mass destruction. It's just not something the Americans seem interested in. And you can draw your own conclusions as to why.
I think after the first search of the top 50 or so sites, when they didn't find anything, I think the U.S. has pretty much said, well, we're probably not going to find any weapons of mass destruction. In fact, Donald Rumsfeld said as much this week. He said, well, the U.N. inspectors didn't find anything. We probably won't find anything either.
Yeah.
And he's right.
Won't. Yeah. And if you do find something at this late date, I mean, the longer it goes on, the more likely it is that whatever it was that was there was not there when Saddam Hussein was in power.
Or that it was stolen by people who were guarding it, and they've already sold it off to another government, or, you know, I mean, it's been looted probably.
Yeah.
And any other information that's left has been destroyed or looted, I'm sure.
Well, it's nice that Donald Rumsfeld mentioned the UN and international community. They are looking at trying to get back involved with this, and the U.S. doesn't seem too involved. Too interested in.
Well, the U.S. needs the international community right now. It needs the U.N. to do something very, very important in regards to Iraq, and that's to lift the sanctions on Iraq. The sanctions are still in place, and the sanctions determine how much oil can be sold and what that money can be used for, and that money has to be used for humanitarian purposes, for food, for medicine, for the Iraqi people.
And
not,
Texaco is very concerned about this.
Yeah. Not for the U.S. military occupation or to pay the U.S.'s war expenses, which is what the Bush administration would like to do with the funds from the sale of Iraqi oil. And so the Bush administration needs the U.N. Security Council, including the countries that were very much against the war, France, China, Russia, Germany, to say, yes, okay, let's lift the sanctions. In the meantime, both France and Russia have said, what do we want to lift the sanctions for until you allow the... Why would we lift the sanctions unless you allow the UN to have some kind of role in Iraq, particularly in peacekeeping, doing something more than just providing humanitarian aid, and in particular looking at where the funds that come from the oil, the sale of oil, are spent.
And why would a regime that has been installed by an illegal invasion be considered legitimate and be ceded by the UN? I mean, there's all sorts of of reasons why the UN has...
Particularly when this is an illegal war.
Yeah, all sorts of reasons why the UN would be in no particular hurry at all to accommodate the Bush administration.
Now, the U.S. really needs them to lift the sanctions for one big reason, is that during the weeks of the war, a lot of the oil pipelines continued to pump oil into storage bins at their end point of the pipeline terminals. There are storage bins that store the oil and wait for tankers and tanker trucks to come and pick it up and ship it out. Now, no oil was shipped during the war, yet the pipelines, particularly the northern pipelines, continued to pump oil. Those storage bins are now full, and there's no place to pump oil anymore. And so the oil field workers are having to start to shut down the oil wells. There's a problem when you shut down oil wells. When you do that, it can lower the pressure in the ground. Now, there's all kinds of geological forces that I could explain, but I won't go into them. But when you shut down an oil well, it changes the pressure underground, and it can make it much, much harder to get the oil pumping again, and then you might not have as much pressure as you had before, making it harder to get the oil out of the ground, or making it likely that you would get less of the resources out of the ground. So the U.S. is concerned because it could damage the oil fields if they can't get the sanctions lifted soon and can't get the oil flowing soon. Right now, there's also another problem in the northern oil fields in particular. It was the looting that went on around Kirkuk. The U.S. military went in and secured the wellheads. They secured the oil well wellheads, but they didn't secure the accompanying buildings. They didn't secure the warehouses that contained all of the replacement parts and all of the equipment and infrastructure for actually working on the oil wells. They didn't secure the buses that ship the oil field workers in to work on the oil fields. They didn't secure the administration offices or the plants. So now they're talking about, instead of getting the oil fields working in 2 to 4 weeks, as the Bush administration had originally estimated, they're talking about 3 to 4 months, because they have to replace all of that equipment, all of those vehicles, all of those buses that looters took.
And that's assuming, given the impending civil wars, that they can remain secure.
Yeah, so in the meantime, they're already looking at some damage to the northern oil fields and having to shut down those wellheads while they replace all of the stuff that was looted. But they're also worried about the southern fields now, too, because all of the southern tanks are full and there are no tankers coming in to take the oil.
All right. Well, we only got a couple minutes left. Let's mention for people events that are happening this week.
Yeah, there's a couple interesting ones. On Monday night, and unfortunately we didn't get a chance to talk about it today, Lynn Stewart, who's a New York City human rights lawyer, member of the National Lawyers Guild, et cetera, who was arrested last year by the Bush administration and charged with terrorism because of her representation of the cleric accused in 1993 and since convicted of the World Trade Center bombings.
Of inspiring the World Trade Center bombers.
And, basically. And she's been charged with terrorism basically for representing him. And it's an enormously important test case for the John Ashcroft's massively expanded post 9/11 regulations in terms of monitoring and violating attorney-client privilege without any kind of court supervision, without anything really more than the Department of Justice's interest. She will be in town Monday night at Seattle University at Wyckoff Auditorium. That's at 7 o'clock. Wednesday night, there's also a very interesting thing going on UW's campus at Kane Hall, room 120, and that is the health consequences of war, with Charlie Clement and some other very good people talking about what we can look for in Iraq around uranium and munitions and a number of the other environmental consequences
of the war.
Things that are put in the air by the bombing and think World Trade Center and Manhattan writ large in terms of the environmental contamination that happened there. So those things are going on also. And then I want to put in a very quick plug, since we didn't have time for it, that people should pay attention to some of the things happening internationally that we didn't get a chance to talk about. Another ISM person was killed this past week in Britain, and a cameraman this week from Britain, in Israel, in the West
Gaza
Bank.
Strip,
in the Gaza Strip. We had a cameraman shot yesterday in the West Bank, and we've had a number of dissidents rounded up and tortured in Zimbabwe and Cuba. So,
all right. With that, we're out of time. Talking this week with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And very quickly, where can people get Eat the State?
It's a free publication that comes out every couple weeks in bookstores and cafes and whatnot. Also on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you want more information, have questions, whatever, our voicemail is 206-901-9463. 903-9461.
Yeah.